Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak, here with my co-host John Wells. Today in the program, we'll talk about a dream accomplished by four high school students from the desert near Phoenix, who defied all odds, built an underwater robot, and entered a competition up against the likes of students from MIT and others. It's a story of triumph, and it's been made into a documentary called Underwater Dreams. Today, we'll be joined by Mary Mazzio, the writer and director of the documentary.
What a great story, Lynn. I'm looking forward to that conversation. Well, next, scientists at Utah State University in Logan are making international news as they lead the charge, shall we say, in devising better ways to charge electric cars. We'll be joined by Dr. Doug Lemon of the Utah State University, who is part of the team working on this new technology. These two stories, plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only on KPCW, only in Park City.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
The Spur Bar and Grill is proud to support KPCW. Located down the alley at 352 Main Street, The Spur features live music, cocktails, and Southern Pub Grub. Open daily at 5 p.m. Our website, thespurbarandgrill.com, includes music schedules, menus, and contact information.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak here with my co-host, John Wells. Well, it's a story kind of like David and Goliath or something within that realm. It's four high school kids with nothing to lose and a lot of humility going up against engineering powerhouses like MIT with an underwater robot. They entered into a competition sponsored by NASA and the Office of Naval Research, among others. The students were four boys from a Title I school in the desert near Phoenix, where most of the students live in poverty. They enlisted the help of oceanic engineers for design help. They used cheap materials from places like the Home Depot. But theirs is a tale of perseverance, a little luck, and really what can happen when people believe. Like the boys, two high school teachers who signed them up for the competition originally. What results is captured in a documentary written and directed by award-winning filmmaker Mary Mazzio. The documentary is Underwater Dreams. Mary Mazzio is joining us by phone this morning. Mary, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Lynn, thank you for having me. Delighted to be with you this morning.
Well, it is such a great story, and as I watched the trailer, there were already tears running down my cheeks. It is a story of triumph, but it's really about defying odds, and maybe you can start with a little history. I notice these four boys are now a little older, maybe mid-30s.
Not quite. This happened 10 years ago.
Oh, okay.
And as you mentioned, earlier, I mean, here were four boys in the middle of the desert, right, with two very energetic teachers, I might add, that built this underwater robot really out of bits and pieces from Home Depot and, like, some chewing gum, right, and maybe some duct tape. And they hauled across the country and entered into this competition. They walked in. And here they are. They're four Hispanic boys, right? They've got their jeans around their waist, right? They're a little scruffy, and they're the only Hispanic team. And so they felt a bit overwhelmed, and they put their robot in the water, and their robot, named Stinky, by the way, sank, like dead on arrival. And the boys, you know, here you have these four boys, sons of migrant workers, undocumented, right? And the boys were like, wait a minute, what's that stuff? We have a leaking mechanical housing. How are we going to fix this? What's that desiccant? Desiccant. Wait, it's funny. I didn't even know the word desiccant before I made this project, by the way. And they said, yeah, that absorbs water, and it's in diapers. And then one boy said, no, we can't fit a diaper in this mechanical housing. And another boy said, well, I bet we could fit some tampons. And so they drew straws, right? And Lorenzo lost, so he had to go get the tampons. And they were up all night testing the tampons to determine how much water it would hold. You know, they having no clue at all. It was just hilarious. And they stuffed about eight Super Plus tampons into the mechanical housing. And Stinky goes on to win the day. They end up defeating MIT. And what's really kind of a magical moment, the boys could not believe it. I mean, they felt like they were walking on air.
Mm.
But Lynn, I think the most remarkable piece around the story is not that they beat MIT, because that's just really cool. It's a great underdog story. But rather what they did for their community. I mean, they came from a community that many of the kids talked about the reputation of the school. Back then, they had a number of gangs in the school. And when these kids came back, they really helped to change the culture. You know, you had four boys on this team. Now you go, and there's 50 kids.
Mm.
Not 2,000, but there's 50. And all these kids are talking about college. And that was a word that really wasn't used 10 years ago in this community.
Right.
And so the boys really, they don't even know what they've done. That I know. They don't think of themselves as special or heroic, but that's what they did. They inspired the next generation of students. And so now you have these kids streaming to ASU to study mechanical engineering or aerospace engineering or solar engineering. And it's really, really exciting to see what they did and frankly, what they're capable of. The other thing that they did that was really remarkable was they spawned some of these engineers have gone off to places like Stanford, right? The kids after them. And why? Because they saw that something could be possible. That's what these boys did. They made the future was still going to be hard, really, really hard. But they made, they dropped, it was a few drops of hope.
Mary, let me interrupt you here. Let's go back 10 years to that high school classroom. They had these enthusiastic teachers. And was it sort of an instance of kids not knowing what they couldn't do or kids not knowing that they were little fish in this huge pond? And so they just went for broke.
That's such a great question. And yes, I think that's exactly what happened. The kids were like, they totally got into it. They were all business. They had no expectations. In fact, they all got together and decided that they were going to enter the collegiate division of this competition and not the high school version.
And why was that?
Because the teachers were deathly afraid that the boys would be completely demoralized if they entered the high school division and came to last. So the teacher said, well, guys, maybe just think about the college division. What's the worst thing that happens? Colleges beat us, so what? We're high school team. Isn't that hilarious?
I like it. So put yourself in an even bigger pond, and it feels okay
exactly.
If you don't succeed.
So it must
exactly.
have been
and
it must have been a real shock when they showed up at the competition and these other teams had their little uniforms on or they had the same T-shirts and things, and they're competing with teams sponsored by ExxonMobil, and also MIT, I think, was represented there. It must have been a little intimidating.
The boys felt completely overwhelmed. I mean, they walked in, they were shiny robots. They saw anodized metal frames. They saw ExxonMobil stickers. They saw resources that they didn't have, right? And I think at first they sort of blanched and felt nauseous, and then they got down to business. I mean, they felt like once they put this robot in the water, game on. And the teachers were just so nervous, but the kids really weren't. The kids had practiced over and over, not only the makeup of the robot, but the other aspects of the competition, which was you've got to make a presentation to a panel of judges in English, which was their second language,
mm-hmm.
right? They had to basically defend their thesis. Why did they design it the way they did? Why were the grabbers working? You know, what was the spy camera doing, et cetera, et cetera. And so the boys fundamentally, engineering-wise, knew what they were doing.
And what were the tasks that the underwater robot had to achieve?
Oh, there were several. One was to find an acoustic pinger, you know, kind of like this beep, beep at the bottom of the sea floor. So the competition had like a mock-up sunken ship. And so you had to find sort of like a beacon, which the boys did not do. And surprising to themselves, they had to extract red liquid from a barrel, and that was to simulate an oil leak, right? Like in mm-hmm. real life. Mm-hmm. So how do you test the contamination? And the boys had never been able to achieve that in practice. And in the competition, they felt like one of them described the, you know, almost like it was a divine intervention, because the boys were working together sort of, you know, really beautifully, and all of a sudden they were able to extract the liquid. Oh my God, this is exciting. What else can we do?
So Mary,
they had to retrieve other tasks, like pick up a bell, you know, a captain's bell, and several other things, buoyancy tests, and measure buoyancy and temperature.
So these four boys came into the competition really having some background knowledge. I mean, you couldn't just throw together some PVC and duct tape and tampons to create something. I mean, they really had to have had some background in engineering of some sort, didn't they? Or is it... Go ahead.
They really did. They really did, Lynn. And what was so fascinating was the boys started calling... the teachers would say, well, we don't know. We might need, like, syntactic foam for buoyancy. And how do we build it? And the boys, and he encouraged the boys, both teachers encouraged the boys, well, call somebody who knows. These boys got on the horn, started calling, you know, oceanographic and military engineers, right? How do we deal with this buoyancy problem? We can't afford this kind of foam. Well, let's see. Let's test the buoyancy of PVC. All right, this is floating. This is good. This is interesting. And so they made it their business to call experts, which I think is just a really wonderful lesson.
Oh, absolutely.
Because
they had no money, precisely.
So 10 years ago, I would assume that robotics clubs in high school, that hadn't really gotten going, and yet, I know here in Park City, there has been a robotics club for maybe the last 4 years or so, and it's becoming something popular. But what was the climate at that time for things like robotics in high schools?
I think, you know, first robotics for sure. So this team had an underwater robot, and then they also had a land robot in the other part of the season. So they competed in first robotics, which I think first robotics served around, you know, 50 to 100,000 kids a year. It's really exciting. It was started by Woody Flowers, a professor from MIT, and Dean Kamen, the inventor of the Segway. And it's really, they started this because they said, you know, in schools, athletes are held on pedestals, yeah, and they're celebrated and they have competitions. But what about mathematicians, scientists, and engineers? What do these kids have? Everybody wants to compete. Let's make this fun. And let's try and get kids excited, you know, the next generation of engineers excited about engineering. I mean, the country is in desperate need for scientists and mathematicians and engineers. American companies cannot fill the jobs they have. And I think by 2018, there are going to be more than 1 million unfilled jobs in American companies.
Wow.
Because we are not producing enough skilled engineers, mathematicians, scientists. Right. So that's a pretty interesting phenomenon. And here you have kids like this in the middle of Phoenix, in the middle of the desert, who are ready, willing, and able to step up and want to step up. And I think that's really at the heart of the film, is it's really about capability and looking in places that may not be immediately obvious. Places like, you know, disenfranchised poor neighborhoods, because those kids, particularly first-generation immigrants, the work ethic and the patriotism mm-hmm. that first-generation immigrants have is really exciting.
Well, this is a great story that you tell very well. But there's a story within
Thank
the
you,
story.
John.
Yeah, but there's a story within the story. Your documentary takes a dramatic turn as we learn that all four of the Hispanic men who were attending Carl Hayden Community High School were undocumented immigrants.
Exactly. And, you know, many of these kids did not understand what it meant. You know, they were brought here as 1 or 2 year olds, 4 or 5 year olds. They had no idea what the word undocumented meant until they either tried to enroll in ROTC or tried to get a driver's license. Well, wait a minute. No, no, no. You can't. Hmm. Right? And so these boys faced those impediments, and their journey since this day has been really, truly remarkable.
And they were from Arizona. So Arizona had passed a law that prohibited tuition aid to undocumented immigrants. So a lot of these kids have to drop out of school.
Not only that, but Proposition 300 counted as quote-unquote aid. They considered that in-state tuition was a subsidized benefit, and so any undocumented child seeking to further their education had to pay 3 or 4 times. They had to basically pay the out-of-state tuition rate, which really put the cost of an education out of reach. And so no matter where you are on the spectrum, how you feel about immigration, here you have really kids that are American in every way. They've been here their entire lives, that want to build and innovate, want access. They just want an opportunity. And these are kids that can fuel our future. I mean, the Hispanic population is expanding leaps and bounds, and we're an aging population. Whether these kids are documented or not, there is a yawning achievement gap with young Hispanic students. And how do we reach them? How do we get them excited about engineering and mathematics? And not call it engineering and mathematics, right? Because the kids are capable, they're smart, they're able, and they just need a little bit of support, a little bit of water, and they can just flourish. And they will propel our country forward in the years to come if we let them free.
Mm. And that's a good part of what you bring forth in the documentary, not only the story of the competition, but I do want to go back to the competition. In the trailer, you don't say that they won. So it left me going, I wonder what happened. I mean, of course they came in last, right? But you sort of glossed over. You quickly mentioned that they won. How did they win?
They won. So when they came out of, there were three components of the competition, and one was what they called the mission, which was you're in the pool, you're underwater, your robot is doing several tasks. That was worth half the point. When the boys came out of the water, they looked up at the scoreboard, and lo and behold, they were fourth. And they thought, oh, what? Okay, this is cool. Then they wouldn't know the results of the next two sections of the competition until the announcements were made at the end of the day. So the next two components were really interesting. One was, as I alluded to earlier, a presentation to a panel of judges. Mm-hmm. And the boys had practiced the whole ride out from Phoenix to Santa Barbara. They practiced over the intercom. They had cars, two vans, and they practiced their presentation. And they had to defend every design decision that they made with respect to the robot. And so that was worth maybe 80 points. And the final piece was they had to have, you know, a written report and materials, a poster and such like that. And the boys really spent an extraordinary amount of time after school working on this all year. Some of the other teams showed up and tried to kind of do wham-bam, mm-hmm. right? Like, oh, we'll spend a lot of time on our robot, but we're not going to spend a lot of time on our presentation or our paper. And that's where these boys shined, right? They were fully prepared.
Mm. Our guest
In fact, one of the funniest, I was going to say, Liv, one of the funniest moments was the kids came out, they were only in front of the judges for about 20 minutes, and the teacher said, oh my God, what happened? Other teams are going for 40 minutes in an hour. Our kids, oh, it's over. It's all over. Kids were like, what do you mean? And Christian, who was just one of the smartest kids of them all, said, well, you know, they couldn't ask us anything we didn't know. And one of the judges said, well, how come you didn't use PowerPoint like all the other teams? And Christian said, well, the only people that use PowerPoint are people who don't know what they're talking about.
And I agree with that one.
So in our screenings that we've had thus far, we were so privileged to open at Clinton Global and Aspen Ideas. I mean, the crowd just roars when they hear that line, right? The boys are so funny, and they're so lovable, and they're so honest.
So your footage from the movie, you have footage from back then, from, what do you have footage from exactly?
We have footage from the actual competition. We found the cinematographer who was actually underwater 10 years ago, which was no small task, I must say, right? Because how material was stored, and so we also supplement, of course, with a new stinky that was built, and we filmed in the pool, and so we figured we tried to use all the tools in the toolbox to tell the story.
You knew the story, Mary, before you started the documentary project. As you got into the project, what surprised you most about the story, about the kids, anything?
That's a great question, John. Two things surprised me most. First was how aspirational and smart these kids were. I was really blown away, honestly. I think a lot of us have old stereotypes, old preconceptions, and even though I knew it was a great story, to see it and come face-to-face with these kids and to come with the generation of kids that they're inspiring, it is really exciting and it's sobering, because you say to yourself, there are so many impediments to success. How can we help? What can we do? The second thing that really surprised me was I had no idea that we would really bump into the Dream Act and social activism. And the next generation students, many of them went on to start the Arizona Dream Act Coalition. Mm. And I said to them, I said, you're engineers. Why are you so, how did social activism enter into the equation? And they said, Mary, we are trained as engineers. That means it's our job to go solve a problem. Here's the problem, right? We need to solve this. We can contribute so much to the country. We're going to have a voice. And so these kids started the Arizona Dream Act Coalition, and they would hold vigils, and they would pray. And they wouldn't yell. They wouldn't scream. They weren't belligerent. They would pray, and they would write their congressman. And I thought, if that was me, I would be rude. I would be demanding. I would not be, and if it was me, I likely would not have been as brave. And I'm sure that these kids are more patriotic. I was an Olympic athlete, so I consider myself a real patriot. Mm-hmm. These kids, their patriotism is exponential. They're braver, and they put everything at risk to have a voice. And as a 17, 18, 19-year-old kid, to have the fortitude and the strength to do that, I was just so humbled by the people around me, and I thought, boy, I need to be a better person.
Mary, one of the kids was deported after the competition. Is that correct?
No. No, none of the kids were deported, but, or certainly, let me rephrase that. Oscar, he had been in ROTC. He graduated from ASU with an engineering degree. He had an American wife and a baby in the way, and he said, okay, I don't want to be working on a landscape crew. My options are so limited. So he reported himself to Homeland Security, basically deported himself.
Oops.
Went back to Mexico. Yeah, and that was a harrowing experience, because when you do that, you face a 10-year ban from ever entering into this country. And he applied for amnesty, denied. He applied again, denied. And then Senator Durbin was on the Senate floor testifying about, Dreamers and many of these young people who could be incredible assets to this country. And Oscar's name was mentioned. And about 6 months later, Oscar received, a letter saying your visa's been approved. So what did Oscar do? He came home 6 months later, shipped off to basic training. He has now served in Afghanistan, and he's been in the military for 5 years.
Huh. Wow, very
right?
Interesting.
Incredible sacrifice, right? So Again, what I think what the film does is it really shines a light on the, these communities of kids. Some of them are documented, some of them aren't. It's really these kids in disenfranchised neighborhoods, but look what they're capable of.
Mm-hmm. Our guest is Mary Mazzio. She's the writer and director of the movie Underwater Dreams, receiving a wide nationwide release this weekend, I believe, maybe tomorrow.
Yeah. Yes, we start in New York and L.A. We open in Phoenix next week, and then we'll see how robust ticket sales are. But we also have a very special partnership with NBC Universal and AMC Theaters, and we are going to be broadcasting a special television program simultaneously in English and in Spanish on MSNBC and Telemundo July 20th. So everybody in the country will be able to see it. And then we're going to be doing a back-to-school special with NBC, and there are all kinds of really wonderful things happening so that we can get this content really in neighborhoods and classrooms that need it most.
You've got some great people behind this project. You've got the Bezos family, and its executive producers are Jackie and Mike, but they are also one of the major funders, and a number of other people. I mean, you've really got some good people behind this.
You know, John, we were so fortunate. You know, there are, and as I'm discovering, there are so many philanthropists and groups that we're starting to partner with that is really focused on how do we get the next generation of kids really excited about science and engineering, right? Like, this is mission critical for the country. And the Bezos family had started an initiative around what they call STEM education, right? Science, technology, engineering, and math, and particularly focused on Hispanic students because they are an exploding population, and particularly first-generation immigrants, right? There's, and I'm going to totally generalize, but there's an incredible work ethic and entrepreneurial spirit with first-generation immigrants. And so we were so fortunate to have the support of the Bezos family and also the Laureate Innovation Fund early on in this project. So you're right, John. We got very lucky, honestly.
And, you know, something I hadn't previously known about the Bezos Family Foundation, or, well, about Jeff Bezos' parents, Jackie and Mike, was that Mike is actually Miguel, and he came from Cuba, born in Cuba, came when he was 15 to this country and really fought his way up. And
exactly.
A true success story. Very interesting.
Yes, and you could not find two more lovely people on the planet who really their heart is in the right place, and they really care, particularly around education being the equalizer for these children, right? And that's where it starts and ends. You know, give these kids are like flowers. Just give them a little bit of water, and they can bloom, mm-hmm. right?
It's amazing.
Oh,
go ahead.
Yes, no, I was going to say, you know, The more water you can sprinkle around, you have a daisy here, a daisy there. But let's have imagine a whole flock of them and what they can achieve. It's an exciting yet daunting proposition.
And Lynn and I have had a number of guests on Cool Science Radio that have shine a light on the importance of our young people getting involved in STEM, you know, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And we had this one young lady who got involved in a robotics competition, who just had this aha moment where she said, you know something? I'm going to be an engineer. I love this. And when you see that, it just really makes you feel good. And there's lots of different ways to motivate these kids. And I think your documentary is going to help quite a bit.
Thank you, John. I you know, if we can play one small role in the debate, and frankly, I had a CEO, had a really interesting discussion with a CEO after the screening, and if we can change or help to be, you know, part of the change agent around how these kids are perceived and what they're capable of, just very generally, if we can be a cultural piece that will be among many, then that becomes really exciting, right? Where, so many of us focus on what's different about each other, and I think this project shows us how alike we really are.
Mm. Well, congratulations on a wonderful project, and best of luck. Our guest is Mary Mazzio, and the movie is Underwater Dreams, or I should say documentary is Underwater Dreams. Thank you so much for your time today, Mary.
Thank you so much, Lynn and John. And if any of your viewers want any additional information, our website is underwaterdreamsfilm.com.
Okay.
Mary, thanks so much.
Bye
All right,
now.
Thank you to you both. Really appreciate it.
Bye-bye. All right. And this is Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be right back. We'll be speaking about some new technology to charge electric cars, thereby reducing what they call range anxiety. I'd never heard of that before, but
I'm anxious just thinking about it.
We'll be right back.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, formerly Prudential Utah. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW and are excited to embark on the next era of Park City real estate under our new brand. More info at bhhsutah.com.
KPCW and TED are supported by Emerald Data Solutions, whose board docs web applications help governing bodies operate more effectively here in Park City and throughout North America. Board docs services streamline processes used to create and manage board packets, access information, and conduct meetings. BoardDocs.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. All electric cars may help the United States become more energy independent, lower pollution levels, all sorts of good things. But right now, they're not practical in every situation, especially in the West, where people have to travel long distances. As Lynn just mentioned before the break, the fear of running out of power is what they call range anxiety. Limited driving range is now the biggest issue for people considering the purchase of an all-electric car. But now researchers at Utah State University are working on the cure for range anxiety. The university has received approvals to build an oval track to test some new technology for recharging electric vehicles on the go. We have Dr. Doug Lemon with us. He is the past president of the Utah State University Foundation, as well as the director of the Space Dynamics Laboratory. Currently, he's the associate vice president of the Innovation Campus and Development. Dr. Doug Lemon, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Good morning. It's nice to be with you.
Yeah, you've got some great titles there in your name.
Well, it's been an interesting journey.
Yeah. I was brushing my teeth this morning. I've got this electric toothbrush, and it's plastic, and you put it down in this plastic cradle, and there are right. No wires or anything, and it sort of wirelessly charges this thing. Is that kind of what we're talking about here?
That's exactly what we're talking about in terms of the fundamental physics. The toothbrush charger and other wireless devices use, you know, phenomena that have been known for a long time. They go back to the 1820s and 30s when Faraday and Maxwell and Ampere discovered those fundamental laws of electromagnetism. And so exactly what happens in your toothbrush is you have a current in the base of the brush that creates an alternating magnetic field, and that field is generated according to Ampere's law, and then it's received in your toothbrush, and then it senses the alternating magnetic field and in turn creates a current, and that current charges your battery. And so the challenge to take that to a vehicle is you now have to separate the distance between the roadway and the vehicle, and your toothbrush, there's just, you know, fractions of an inch separation, but you get good coupling. And of course, it's very low power.
Right.
So the challenge to power a vehicle is you now need 12 to 15 inches of separation, because you have to bury the pad, you know, beneath a few inches of concrete or pavement, and you have to transfer much more power. And now what we're talking about is actually doing that while the car is moving at 60 miles an hour. So a lot of the principles are the same. It's just a lot harder to do.
Yeah. And have you already successfully done this with the Aggie bus that sort of pulls over this pad that's 12 to 18 inches?
We've successfully demonstrated stationary charging with the Aggie bus. And so we're able to conquer the problems of power and distance. The Agibus we developed when I was the director of the Energy Lab here at Utah State, and we were able to show 25 kilowatts power transfer over about 10 inches, 8 to 10 inches, with and only about a 1% loss in that 10-inch gap, so it's very high efficiency. That bus is now was the kind of springboard for a commercial company called Wave that operates out in West Salt Lake Valley. And they're putting together a 50-kilowatt full-size city bus that will be running on the U of U campus to show this, that you can move 50 kilowatts on a stationary charging. And that works well for fixed routes, but if you want to drive any distance or have more freedom in where you go, the concept we're investigating now is to actually put the power in the roadway so and the power is in the major roadways gets to your battery wirelessly.
Right.
While you're going 80 miles an hour?
60.
Well, 60. 60. Okay. 60, yes. Okay. Whatever's legal.
So, Dr. Lemon, just to give us a perspective on these charging pads, the stationary, and what you've mm-hmm. achieved so far with the 25 kilowatts and then now with the 50 kilowatts for the one to go on the University of Utah campus, what? How many kilowatts do we achieve by plugging in to these? You know, we have a couple parking stalls right outside the radio station here where you plug in. What's the difference in what you achieve?
Yeah, the stationary, well, I don't know exactly what you have there, but in a typical passenger vehicle, there'll be about 3.5 kilowatts for one of our partners, the Y-tricity company. They sell a retrofit system that you can run off of house power. That's about a 3.5 kilowatts. So that gives you an idea of the scale. We have to be many times what you might have in your home in a garage where you could charge your car overnight. We have to be, you know, 10 times or 20 times that in order to power a car.
And is that
in motion?
Okay. For a car in motion, then, what are you hoping to achieve? More?
We have to be 50 to 100 kilowatts. Okay. That's kind of the goals we're looking at is you could get, because the pad, since you're moving at that highway speed, you're not over the pad very long
mm-hmm.
as
mm-hmm.
the car goes rushing by. And so you have to, of course, have several of them, you know, in a row, and then you have to push more power in order to provide sufficient energy for the car.
So how long has have the stationary charging pads been on the market? If they even are on the market.
I'm not sure they're on the market. I know they're under development. I'm not positive.
Okay.
But they're close.
Okay.
Electricity is working on them.
And it seems like from the little I've heard about the stationary charging pads, there have been some things that just aren't lining up. They're not truly feasible just yet at this point of development. Is that right?
I really don't know a good deal about the current what's available for consumers. All I know is that the Aggie bus and the U of U bus, you know, it's working well at those higher powers for the larger vehicles.
So the Aggie bus doesn't have range anxiety?
I love that
term.
Well, it does, but because, again, what they're doing, the value proposition for a city bus is that you get longer life without having to do an overnight charge. If a typical bus, it just right off, you know, goes out on its morning duty, can run about 8 hours on that charge that gets overnight. But they really need the bus to run about 14 hours to be economical. Otherwise, you've got to have more buses because the bus you want to use has to go back to the shop. So you have to bring another bus out to run the next 4 or 6 hours of the shift. But by having stationary charging where it's picking up passengers, they can get that one bus to run 12 or 14 hours, and then it can go back to the, you know, the bus barn and get a full charge overnight. And so that's a life extension in terms of its service, period of service. And those, again, are there on fixed routes because you know where you're going to go pick up people. But if you want to serve consumers who want to just go anywhere, then you've really got to take the power to the roadways. Let me give you a little historical example. When Thomas Edison invented the electric light bulb, you know, it was a huge breakthrough. But just imagine that instead of running the wires, you know, into the buildings and putting light bulbs everywhere you want them, they stopped it saying, well, we'll just give you an electric lantern. We'll give you a battery and we'll hook a light bulb to it, and you still have to carry this lantern everywhere you go. And that's kind of where electric vehicles are today. You can replace gasoline with batteries, but you still have to carry this big, expensive battery with you, and they're slow to charge. So the equivalent transformation that we're trying to achieve is to take the power to where you want it. And just as we run electric wires all through our buildings where we want the power, we want to run power into the highway so you can have a much smaller battery. So if you need to go off-road for off the grid for 20 or 30 or 50 miles, you can do so on an onboard battery, but they're much smaller and lighter. And then you can go to a stationary pad while you're at work or in the grocery store. You get back on the highway, and then once you're on the highway, you can drive as far as you want because you're getting the power and delivered right to where you are.
So, Dr. Lemon, the status is that USU has received approval for a research facility that includes an oval track for the testing and recharging of this technology.
We've received approval from the USU administration to pay for it, and from the trustees, our final approval will be from the regents a week from tomorrow.
And you expect that to happen?
We expect so, but we have to go through that process, and when that's approved, then we hope to, you know, break ground in the next month or so.
And this would be out on Grand Avenue in Logan?
Yes, just south of Grand Avenue, just south of the two U-Star buildings. If you know the Logan campus, we have part of the Innovation Campus here. We're putting kind of the middle of this large field so we can put, you know, higher value buildings toward the edges. But we'll have a nice 60 by 80 foot high bay building and about a quarter mile electrified test track, which will be the first of its kind in America. So we're really excited to have that.
So just as Edison competed with other technologies and eventually won out with his, are there competing technologies for other ways to do it? Do any of the manufacturers like Tesla, do they have ideas of how to do this that might be a little different?
Well, there's a couple of approaches to current electric cars. One is like Tesla, where you stop and you go to a rapid charging station, and you just have to recharge your battery. You know, but most of us don't want to wait, you know, 30 minutes or an hour to stop when we stop and get gas. We're used to 3, 4, or 5 minutes, you know, and then we're on our way. Some people talk about replacing the battery. You go into a station, they pull out your battery, and somebody puts in a new battery. Some say that breakthrough in battery technology will just make all this unnecessary, and you know, our analysis just says that the physics really isn't with you to do that. You have to have so many breakthroughs in cost and weight and power and power density that we just don't think that battery technology alone is going to give you, you know, a 300-mile battery that you can charge in 5 minutes. So we think going to the roadway is, we know how to do that. This approach requires some engineering. It doesn't require any miracles. So we think it's really very feasible to do.
Dr. Lemon, I don't know how familiar you are with battery technology, but, you know, one of the things that, especially that naysayers come up with regarding electric cars is, you know, the resources needed to even manufacture a battery, the toxicity of the battery, and, you know, coming up with carbon footprint-wise, electric cars are no better than fuel-powered, you know, gas engines. And where does battery technology stand right now? Are you familiar enough with that to comment on it?
I'm really not. I can give you a couple of figures, though, relative to the approach we're talking about, where you can take the power to the car, cuts through a lot of that argument, because you now have so much smaller, you know, battery on board. One figure we have calculated in our models is the current state of the art for a battery, the life cycle energy use versus an internal combustion engine is about 80% conventional vehicle. We believe in 10 years we can cut that in half, so we'll be at 40% energy use in the total life cycle of the vehicle per miles driven. So these become very compelling in terms of reducing air pollution, energy usage. Just for example, a current conventional vehicle, 28% of the energy in the tank gets to the wheels. That's not very good. Electric vehicle, we can get 84% of the energy from the grid to the wheel. So the inarguable fact is electric motors are just a lot more efficient than a gasoline engine. And that efficiency drives the economics. We'll eventually have to pay for this because it doesn't make economic sense. No one's going to, finance it and do it. And then there's, of course, environmental benefits because you're removing those tailpipe emissions. At a minimum, you're taking the energy generation out of the cities and the congested areas to some power plant. And ideally, you're able to tap into, more alternative energy sources, wind or solar, and put those into the power grid so you could actually power your cars using those types of sources. So there's a lot of compelling factors that I think will move this forward.
Okay, thanks for that answer. So back to this great oval track that's going to be built in Logan.
Yes.
So the strips where the charging will take place will be about how long?
Well, there'll be the pads themselves are perhaps 15 to 20 inches in diameter, and we're doing about 15-foot sections. So we'll have, just for the economics of the track, we do about 15 or 20 feet of a trench that's a formed concrete trench that we deliver power to. So we can pull the pads in and out and connect them up. We can put different kind of roadway materials between pad and the car, and it's an experimental. And I think we're doing about four or five of those trenched areas so that we can test the car at the 30 to 35 miles per hour will be our maximum speed.
And Dr. Lemon, does the conductivity change between concrete and asphalt and other materials?
They're both non-conductors, and so there's not much difference, and that's one of the things we'll be studying, but neither of them pose much of a barrier. You have to be concerned a little bit about, water.
Right.
And so that's part of what we're investigating, and we'll be looking at summer and winter, and we have plenty of chances to do that in Cache Valley in the wintertime. So there's a lot of those issues. And so in addition to just the electronics of moving the power, we have a parallel program going on just roadway construction, materials, degradation. The idea that if you put these pads in the roadway, you've got to get a 20-year life to have the economics really work for you. And so we were looking at all of those civil engineering aspects as well as the electrical engineering.
For folks that would like to have more information on the Oval Track and this project, how would they get that?
Well, as soon as I get it approved and built, then we'll put something on our website. There's just not much available publicly today because the project hasn't really started. But I'm sure once we get this going, we'll be more than happy to publicize our results.
We have spoken to a couple people, especially in your space dynamics lab up there at Utah State University on this program. We've also spoken to a lot of engineers and bioengineers from the University of Utah. We're constantly surprised and quite delighted that our state universities in this state seem to have the corner on science and technology. It's really amazing.
Well, this is an area where Utah can really step out and be a leader in the world, in that you don't get to do that very often.
Right.
In fact, one of the reasons I'm so enthusiastic about this transformation is there's not many times in a person's career that you see a really fundamental paradigm shift taking place and can be a part of that. You know, the electric vehicle, I mean, the gas car was invented, you know, in 1894 and really became popular with Henry Ford in the early 1900s. You know, our cars today are incredibly better than those, but the model really hasn't changed. You still have to put gas in the tank and drive it down a road.
Mm-hmm.
You got to take all your energy with you. And as marvelous as our new cars are, that's still what we have to do. This transformation just really turns that over, and now you've got electric vehicles, and you're putting the power in the roadway. That's kind of a once-in-a-hundred-year sort of a change, and it'll take 20 more years. We envision even 20% market penetration in 20 years would be wonderful and would have, you know, significant impacts in just carbon reduction and air pollution. So these things take time, but I think people here are pretty excited to be part of it and getting out on the front end. This track will be the first of its kind in this country. We know that one of our partners in Korea, the KAIST Institute, that is their Advanced Science and Technology Institute, they have one of these running. They have a 24-kilometer in-motion bus route. It's a little different approach to it, but it's still a wirelessly powered bus that they're running. The City of London, with a partner, Qualcomm Halo, which is Qualcomm, of course, a big telecom company, they bought rise to some technology that came out of University of Auckland. They'll be putting 50 electric vehicles on the highways in London with wireless charging. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's interesting how these things happen. We hired one of the graduate students out of the University of Auckland, and that's how we got this started. He was a brilliant young man. He was 21 when he finished his PhD in electrical engineering. He started college at 14. And so he was really a treasure. We brought him here, must be 4 years ago now, and he started this work here. We then hired a U-Star professor from Colorado. He was at Colorado Boulder, Dr. Reagan Zane, and he's now heading this program at Utah State, and the young woman from Auckland has moved with our spinoff company, so he's now with WAVE as their chief scientist. And so,
what is his name? Just,
Hunter Wu.
And Dr. Lemon, do these folks collaborate with the other projects around the world?
We certainly hope to be doing so. We've had good relations with the people in Auckland, and one of the proposals we're hope to be awarded from the National Science Foundation. We have agreements from all the world players to participate in our program. So people from Auckland, from KAIST, and all the major car companies have a great deal of interest in this. So we certainly intend to be connected with, again, the world leaders.
Dr. Lemon, we want to thank you so much for being on our show this morning. We could talk to you a bit more, but we're going to have to move on. But thank you very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Stand by. I'm happy to talk to you again when we get a vehicle running around that track.
I think we'll need a field trip, won't we, to Logan?
We'll come see it.
That's going to be a field trip for sure. Thank you, sir. Yeah.
Thank you.
Happy to do it. You're most welcome.
Okay.
Bye.
Well, we want to thank Dr. Doug Lemon, who is currently the Associate Vice President of the Innovation Campus and Development at Utah State University, and, of course, Mary Mazzio, who has put together this brilliant documentary.
Underwater Dreams.
Underwater Dreams.
We'll be right back.
Support for KPCW comes from Wasatch Brew Pub, offering brunch on the patio at the top of Main every Saturday and Sunday, including New York steak and eggs, Wasatch waffles, and French toast, as well as Midday Marys and mimosas. Private event space available. Wasatch Brew Pub, misbehaving in Utah since 1986. WasatchBeers.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. We know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases. 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
And tune in tomorrow at 9:06 a.m. for Mountain Summer, our guest Silly Market, Summit County Fair, and a celebrity chef.
And want to thank our underwriters today, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, and Nexus IT.